Tantor Audio presents Mob Boss, The Life of Little Al Darko, The Man Who Brought Down the Mafia, by Jerry Capecci and Tom Robbins, narrated by Michael Pritchard. Preface. Alfonso Little Al Darko was the most important mob witness in an era that saw the mafia slide into a long and bloody decline. As an acting boss of his crime family, he was the highest-ranking mobster ever to share mafia secrets when he changed sides in 1991. His decision opened the door for others to make the same choice, including John Gotti's top aide, Salvatore Sammy the Bull Gravano. Collectively, their testimony helped send the mob spiraling into near collapse. We got to see him a lot while covering organized crime for the New York Daily News and other papers, where we broke many of the stories of his cooperation and revelations. He was the most effective and compelling witness we ever saw take the stand. He gave no excuses for his own conduct, offering a riveting account of a life of crime. What was also impressive about Al Darko was that he knew not only his own criminal story, but the history of the mob. He clearly had been a careful student of knowledgeable tutors. So when the opportunity arose a few years ago to tell his story, we were immediately interested, provided that we could set the ground rules. First, the book would be written by us. Darko would have no right to review the manuscript or declare any areas of his life off limits. Second, he would have to make himself available, not always an easy prospect for someone in the witness protection program. He agreed, submitting to hundreds of hours of interviews. He also made his wife of 58 years and his oldest son, who followed him into the mob, available as well. Like the FBI agents and prosecutors who debriefed him for even more hours, we never caught him in a lie. Telling the truth was a point of pride with him. We were steadily amazed at his accuracy. One example: when he told us how a young Jewish gangster he had known on Mulberry Street more than 40 years ago had been stabbed to death in a Bronx park by Lucky Luciano's former right-hand man, we were skeptical of being able to confirm it. The murder was not only unsolved, it wasn't even listed anywhere. But after digging out the facts, the details dovetailed exactly as he had described them. This book is based on those interviews, along with thousands of pages of court transcripts, FBI memos, affidavits, and other documents. We also interviewed more than 36 agents, detectives, prosecutors, and defense attorneys. Any mistakes here are our own, no one else's. Al Darko's story is many things. It's a true inside account of what was supposed to be a secret society. It's also the story of a killer whose crimes were unforgivable, no matter how much they were part of the life, as he and his fellow mobsters dubbed the world they inhabited. It's also a story of New York, its streets, its neighborhoods, and its residents, some infamous, some long forgotten. At one point, when Al Darko's career goal to become a made member was being blocked, he was offered a chance to skip the wait and join another family. He'd instantly have a lot of money and a big house. The catch was he would have to move to Pittsburgh. "No thanks," he said. He was a New Yorker. He wanted to stay that way. Part 1. La Scuola delle Strade. 1. The Call. On the evening of September 21st, 1991, a veteran agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation named Robert Marston got a call at his home in the Connecticut suburbs. It was 7 o'clock on a Saturday night, and Marston and his family were just headed out the door. Neighbors were picking them up to drive them to a local church fair. The phone rang just as the neighbors arrived. Marston picked it up in the living room as his wife and two young children went outside. On the other end was an operator from the Bureau's New York switchboard, which handled after-hours calls to the agency. "I have a call for Agent Marston," a nasal-toned operator said. "Will you accept it?" He said he would. He waited a moment for the call to be patched through. On the line was someone involved in an investigation that Marston was conducting into an illegal landfill. He'd spoken to the man several times, but he couldn't imagine why he would be calling him on a weekend evening. Whatever it was, he hoped it wouldn't take long. He could see his wife chatting with their friends, casting anxious glances at the living room window. The caller sounded nervous and rushed. He was speaking almost in code. "There's this guy I know, and he's involved with things. I'd like you to speak to him. I think he can tell you a lot," he said. Marston asked who it was. "His name is Al Darko," said the caller. The agent had to skip a few beats to catch up with that one. For the past year, he had been trying to wrap up his probe into a dump along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania. It had started as a routine environmental crime case. That was Marston's beat. He chased illegal dumpers, the corner-cutting trash haulers who tossed medical waste into the ocean, and toxic garbage down open mine pits. He was part of what the Bureau called a white-collar squad. They pursued crooks who stole with pen and paper, not guns. It was why the Bureau's elite mob-chasing agents referred to them as the sharp pencil guys. They were smart investigators, very good at deciphering financial records, but lacking in the street savvy needed to handle real wise guys. Marston wouldn't have disagreed with that analysis. He had an MBA and had been on the verge of becoming a certified public accountant when his application to the FBI had been accepted. But despite the white-collar nature of his work, several authentic wise guys had walked into the landfill case just the same. One of them had ended up dead in the trunk of his late model Jaguar, his blood leaching out onto the Bronx street where the car was abandoned. On court-ordered wiretaps, Marston's team had heard dump operators voice greatest concern about someone in Lower Manhattan's Little Italy named Al. Whoever Al was, he was a mobster with high-level clout in the Lucchese crime family, one of New York's five mafia clans. They'd eventually learned Al's last name, Darko. He had done two terms in prison, one for stock theft and another for heroin sales. Their interest had soared when they'd learned earlier that year from the Bureau's mafia specialists that Darko was serving as his crime family's acting boss. He was the pinch hitter for the family's two top figures, Boss Vittorio Vic Amuso and underboss Anthony Gaspipe Casso. Both men had gone into hiding just before their indictment on racketeering charges the year before. That was where the intelligence had stopped. They had never heard his voice on the wiretaps or spotted him in a meeting. Al Darko was someone hidden in the corners. And now he wanted to talk to Bob Marston? He said that of course he would speak to him. The caller said he'd have Darko call Marston right back on the same number. Then he hung up. A few moments later, the phone rang again. Outside on the lawn, his wife looked up at the sound of the ring. She gave an exasperated shrug. He held up a finger. He'd be a minute. "Agent Marston, I have someone on the line who doesn't want to say who he is," said the high-pitched operator. "That's all right," he said. "Put him through, please." He heard a voice with a deep Brooklyn accent. "Mr. Marston, my name is Al." The caller paused. "Do you know who I am?" "Yes, I think I do," he said. "Okay, good. I was told you were someone I could talk to." This is how Hollywood would have a wise guy sound, the agent thought. Street tough and tense. It suddenly flashed through Marston's mind that this was a gag, a couple of co-workers jerking his chain. In his office in New Rochelle, just north of New York City, everyone knew he'd been hammering away at the landfill case. And everyone knew that he'd lately been chasing his own white whale, a mobster named Darko. On the other hand, if the caller was who he said he was, this could be a very significant phone conversation. Robert Marston was 39 years old. He'd been with the FBI for 12 years, long enough to know that agents spent entire careers hoping for calls like this. "If I screw this up," he thought, "how am I ever going to explain it?" Marston's wife was now waving her hands, beckoning him to come on. She cupped her hand to her mouth. "Will you please hang up the phone and get into the car?" she yelled. He waved back just as urgently, signaling her not to wait for him. She shook her head. "I'd be glad to talk," said Marston. They were both silent for a moment. "This is like an awkward first date," the agent thought. "How can I help?" he added. Darko began to talk. His words spilled out in a fast, agitated flow. Marston couldn't understand everything he said. It was a mob stream of consciousness, as though he had come in halfway through a conversation the gangster was having with himself. People had tried to kill him, he got that much. And Darko wanted to retaliate. He heard that as well. He had weapons at his disposal, and he was prepared for anything that happened, he said. "I never broke the rules," the mobster kept saying. Marston just listened. This had to be authentic. His agent pals could never be this creative. He made sympathetic sounds. His chief goal, he decided, should be just to keep Al Darko on the phone, to keep him from bolting. "Tell me what's going on," he said, trying to sound encouraging. Darko told him he was in a house on Long Island. His son Joseph was with him. He didn't give an address, and Marston didn't press him. Marston couldn't tell whether the men Darko said were after him were right outside the house or far away. If the threat was imminent, he said, they might be better off just dialing 911. "We could have police cruisers there in a couple minutes if you want." "No," responded Darko in a low voice. "It's not that imminent." He next sounded almost embarrassed for having raised an alarm. "I don't need any help protecting myself," he said loudly. "And I can take care of my family. I've been doing it all my life." All he wanted to do was talk, he insisted. "I'm willing to do this for a few minutes right now," he said. "But that's it. Nothing else," he said. "That's fine," said the agent. "Let's just talk." He looked outside. The car was gone. So was his family. Again, there was silence on the other end of the line. Marston started filling in the space. He told Darko a little about himself. He was from upstate New York, he said. He told him where he worked and the kind of cases he did. As he spoke, Marston tried to keep his own voice as normal as possible, as though he were talking to a neighbor at the church fair he now knew he'd miss. He was trying to avoid being pulled into the undertow of the tough Brooklyn accent. It was something he had seen other agents lapse into when talking to hoods from the street. In a bid to gain their confidence, they imitated their language, their gestures, even their dress. Marston had no illusions about who he was. He was a suburban WASP. If he was to start talking like a tough guy, Al Darko would instantly spot him as a fake. Worse, he would consider it condescending. He'd hang up and go a million miles away. Darko sounded somewhat reassured by what he heard. He said he was glad to know that Marston wasn't one of the FBI men that followed the Lucchese family. "Those guys have been harassing me," he said. An agent had recently stopped him in the street, he claimed, loudly thanking Darko for helping them, making it appear as though he were cooperating.
"He was trying to get me killed," said Darko.
The rant against the Bureau continued for several minutes. He began a new tirade against those who were after him. Then he paused and seemed to take a breath.
"If I was to come with you," he said, "what could you do for me?"
Marston felt a slight panic as he realized he had no idea what the answer was. He'd never handled a mob cooperator. Instinct told him to be honest about that. "Well, I don't know exactly, Mr. Darko. I've never done this kind of thing before." He said he'd quickly find out, though. And then he added some reassurance about some things he knew he could honestly pledge. "What I will tell you, though, is that I will never lie to you. I won't make any promises I can't keep. And I'll never mislead you. If I don't know the answer to something, I will tell you I don't know." Darko seemed to appreciate his honesty about his ignorance.
"Well, I got an idea of who you are," he said. "And I think maybe you are someone I can talk to."
Marston said he felt the same way. What they should do, the agent said, was talk again in a little while after he'd had a chance to speak to his bosses, who would have a better idea of how to proceed. He looked at his watch. It was 8 p.m. "Why don't you call me back at 8:30? He said. As he said it, he wondered if he was making a huge mistake. He might never hear from Al Darko again. Maybe the people who had tried to kill Darko, whoever they were, would find him before the FBI did. But he didn't know what else to do.
"Okay," said Darko. "I'll call you then."
Marston hit the switch hook on the phone and began dialing. He couldn't reach his supervisor, but he found Mike Flanagan, the assistant special agent in charge of his squad, the ASAC in the Bureau shorthand. Flanagan lived nearby. His brother John was also an agent and a member of the unit that chased the Lucchese family that Al Darko had just told him he loathed. Breathlessly, Marston told Flanagan he had just been on the phone with the acting boss of the Lucchese crime family. He was talking about cooperating.
"Okay," the squad leader said calmly, as if this happened every week.
"We're going to talk again," said Marston. "This could lead to something."
"Get as many agents as you need, Bob," Flanagan told him. "See if you can bring them in. Spend what you have to spend. Let's hope it works out."
That was easy, Marston thought when he got off the phone. His next call was to his partner, Jim O'Connor, who had been working the landfill case with him.
"You're kidding," said O'Connor.
"I thought maybe someone was kidding me," said Marston. He made a few more calls to agents he knew would be eager to interrupt their Saturday nights for a mission like this. The Bureau had a SWAT team, and Marston was friendly with a couple of its members. He asked everyone to just stand by. He wasn't sure they were going anyplace. Yet. His phone rang again a little after 8:30. The operator knew the routine.
"I have your party, Mr. Marston," she said.
"How you doing, Mr. Marston?" came the voice.
He told Darko that he had been authorized to bring Darko to a safe location. He asked if any other members of his family were with him.
"No, it's me and my son Joseph," said Darko. "We're out at my mother's place on Long Island."
Marston asked how many were in his family. Darko seemed to be counting.
"Including my mother, my kids, my sister, my nephew, it's 12, he said.
He had sent his wife, his daughters, and another son away that morning, he added.
"I know they're safe. I don't have to worry about them right now."
He started to ramble again about how the rules were being broken. Mobsters were now going after families.
"That was never allowed," he said.
Marston waited for another opening. "One thing at a time," he thought. "We're going to start with you and Joseph," he said. "Why don't you give me the location of where you are right now? We will come and get you." There was silence on Darko's end. "I lost him," thought Marston. "He's going to back off." Then he heard the Brooklyn accent giving him an address on the north shore of Long Island. Late that night, Alfonso Darko, a balding 59-year-old lifelong gangster, known as Little Al for his modest height, became the highest-ranking member of the mafia ever to defect to the government. Other than sounding like one of the dead-end kids circa 1935, he wouldn't have been anyone's idea of a mob boss. He didn't smoke or drink, aside from an occasional glass of wine. He had been faithfully married to the same woman since 1955. There were no mob girlfriends tucked away on the side. He didn't gamble or bet on the races. He was a vegetarian, shunning meat on the advice of a prison doctor. And he was a true workaholic. His greatest satisfaction was staying busy, running a pair of restaurants and overseeing the extensive holdings of his crime family. But he was a mobster by both choice and conviction.
"I was born made," he liked to say of a life of crime that began as a teenager in the streets near Brooklyn's Navy Yard.
Closing the door on that life was like stepping into a void. He was entering a world he had always viewed with suspicion and loathing. It was a core belief in gangland. There was no honor among cops and agents. They were capable of anything. They were as crooked as the criminals they chased, only less honest about it. The problem for Al Darko was that he had no place left to go. He had become an orphan in his own crime family. terrified as he was of the new world he was entering. He was certain of the fate awaiting himself and his loved ones if he stayed where he was. A few nights before, he had sat in a hotel room in Midtown Manhattan surrounded by his mafia colleagues. It was supposed to be a mob business meeting. Gambling, loan sharking, labor shakedowns, even a plan to grab control of the market for cardboard at produce stores, were all on the agenda. Toward the end of the meeting, he had spotted a concealed gun tucked in a member's waistband. He then realized something else was planned as well. His partners were going to kill him, right there in the hotel room. He had been hearing the whispers all summer. "Al is no good," was the word being spread on the Little Italy streets. "Be careful with Al." Men he had known for years, longtime associates he considered good friends, were keeping their distance. He had been labeled an informant, a rat. It wasn't true, but he knew the truth wouldn't help. Over the past 2 years, at the direction of his mob bosses, he had helped kill other men about whom the same claim had been made. He had harbored strong doubts about the accusations. But he had gone along. It was part of his mob oath, following orders. He had also watched as the retribution was extended to families as well. That was also supposed to be against the rules. You didn't punish personal family members for the alleged sins of sons or fathers. But everyone, it seemed, had changed their minds about that one. Before he had fled the hotel room, he had listened to an acting boss of another mob family, an old-school gangster, loudly insist that the way to end the threat of mob cooperators was simple. Kill their entire families. Listening, Al Darko felt like he was looking in a mirror. Now they were doing it to him. He was not the first mafia defector. A handful of other sworn members before him had made the same abrupt turn in their careers, including a trio of mob captains and a small squad of soldiers. But as a former acting boss, Al Darko was several notches higher than those who had preceded him. He was different for another reason as well. Earlier mob turncoats had suddenly seen the light and agreed to cooperate when facing long prison terms or seeking to reduce sentences they were already serving. The night Darko dialed the FBI's number in New York, he had no legal matters pending against him. No one was even close to having a criminal case that they could prove. Even Bob Marston wasn't sure his investigation of the crooked landfill would ever be able to tie Darko close enough to the scheme for an indictment. Nor had he been caught in any parole violations, usually the soft underbelly for even the shrewdest mobsters. He had been on a special 10-year parole since his release from prison in 1986. All the government had to do was catch him meeting with any of the convicted felons who made up his circle of friends and associates. It would be enough to put him back behind bars for years. He had protected himself by carefully avoiding all the easy targets. He shied away from weddings, funerals, social club meetings, all those surveillance opportunities for agents and police. Out of an abundance of caution, he had even skipped his younger son John's wedding in June. It meant he missed the congratulations and good wishes offered by representatives of all five crime families who were present largely out of respect for the groom's father. He had to satisfy himself with hearing the stories later. In some ways, he was like the first government cooperator. Back in 1963, Joseph Valachi had broken the mob vow of omerta, silence, by acknowledging the existence of something he identified as Cosa Nostra. It was a crucial breakthrough for law enforcement. Like Al Darko, Valachi also believed he was marked for assassination when he turned. In prison in Atlanta, he had been so rattled that he had murdered another inmate he mistook for a potential assassin. But there were differences as well. Valachi's testimony before a U.S. Senate committee made riveting television. Charts of mafia family hierarchies compiled with his assistance served as investigative roadmaps for years to come. But aside from the publicity, Valachi's effectiveness was limited. He testified only once, sending a single mobster to prison. In contrast, 10 years after Al Darko decided to change teams, the scorecard compiled by prosecutors showed that his testimony had helped win convictions of more than 50 mobsters. Among them were the bosses of four crime families. One of them was the legendarily elusive leader of the Genovese crime family, Vincent Gigante. Darko's testimony helped prove that the Chin's bathrobe-clad saunters through the Greenwich Village streets were a feigned effort to pretend insanity and avoid prosecution. All told, Al Darko took the stand 16 times over the next 15 years. He was listed as a potential witness in more than 40 other cases that never went to trial. Defendants, including some of the most powerful members of Cosa Nostra, threw in the towel and accepted plea deals rather than have juries hear what Darko had to say about them.
"He was the best," said Michael Campi, a former FBI supervisor who headed the elite 150-member squad pursuing organized crime in New York.
"Al Darko was the most significant made member to cooperate," said Campi, who spent 20 years hunting wise guys. "He really built that bridge for others to cross."
"He was equally convincing to juries. He was one of the toughest, most difficult witnesses I ever faced," said Gerald Chargell, the noted criminal defense attorney who saw two clients, including Lucchese boss Vic Amuso, convicted after Darko took the stand against them. "He had an uncanny memory. FBI agents who spent months debriefing him found him to be a kind of mafia rain man. Asked for details about Italian crime syndicates, he ticked off the names of 26 different mob factions on the island of Sicily. He then listed the cities and neighborhoods where their American representatives could be found. He sketched out a 12-page history of the roots of the American mafia for the Italian counterpart of the FBI, the Direzione Investigativa Antimafia, identifying 24 American mobsters who had originated in Italy. He walked agents through the mob's business dealings, ranging from which crime family had the rights to sell bread to vendors at the San Gennaro Festival on Mulberry Street in Little Italy, to how the mafia had made fortunes on the demolition of the old West Side Highway in Manhattan and the construction of a Long Island nuclear power plant. He listed the trade unions under mob control, identifying by number and location which locals fell under the sway of which crime families and which members. Despite romantic claims that drug dealing was banned within the mob, he identified a roster of more than 40 mafiosi actively dealing narcotics. He provided the answers to more than a score of unsolved homicides, some of them long ago abandoned in the cold case files. He was also a repository of mob lore. He had been taught by a succession of old-school mafia mentors. They had passed along their oral history, like tribal chieftains teaching pupils without books. Mafia soldiers had fought alongside Sicilian sheepherders in the range wars in Colorado at the turn of the century, he told the agents. He had known ancient veterans of those battles, he said. He told the story of how auto magnate Henry Ford had traded the once legendary mafia powerhouse Joseph Joe Adonis Dotto a lucrative contract to transport cars from plants in New Jersey in exchange for mob muscle to help with his labor problems. When the agents went to check, they saw the record of Adonis's contract. "You're a walking crime encyclopedia," one of New York's most knowledgeable mob investigators, Kenneth McCabe, told him. He was that, but he was something else as well. He was also a murderer. He confessed his own role in a dozen killings and the unfulfilled murder plots against many more. He expressed regret about many of the deaths he had helped arrange, not because of any compunction about the snuffed-out lives, but because he ultimately realized his mob bosses had concocted allegations against those victims just as they had against him. But regret wasn't the same as guilt. He expressed more remorse about having once shot a German shepherd guarding a warehouse he was robbing than about the man he had helped bludgeon to death in a vicious assault in a Queens bagel bakery. Death came with the territory mobsters inhabited, he firmly believed. "It's blood in, blood out," he said repeatedly of his chosen vocation.
He had simply dodged his own bullet, he believed, in a bid to save the lives of his wife and family.
2. Kent Avenue. When he took the stand in court as a government witness, Al Darko was asked how he became involved in the mob in the first place.
"Well, It was always around my neighborhood, in my family, he began.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?